Part 2. The Cyclops. Chapter 18. October 25th, 1989. Key West, Florida. Pitt lay with his back pressed against the cool concrete of the airstrip, looking up at the Prosper Tier. The sun pushed over the horizon and slowly covered her worn hull in a shroud of pastel orange. The blimp had an eerie quality about it, or so it seemed in Pitt's imagination, an aluminum ghost unsure of where it was supposed to haunt. He'd been awake most of the time during the flight from Washington to Key West, poring over Buck Caesar's charts of the old Bahama Channel and retracing Raymond LeBaron's carefully marked flight path. He closed his eyes, trying to get a clear picture of the Prospertier's spectral wanderings. Unless the gas bags inside the blimp were reinflated from a ship, an extremely unlikely event, the only answer to Raymond LeBaron's whereabouts lay in Cuba. Something nagged at his mind, a thought that kept returning after he unconsciously brushed it aside, a piece of the picture that became increasingly lucid as he began dwelling on it. And then suddenly it crystallized. The flight to trace LeBaron's trail was a setup. A rational and logical conclusion remained a dim outline in a thick mist. The trick was to try to fit it into a pattern. His mind was casting about for directions to explore when he sensed a shadow fall over him. "Well, well," said a familiar voice, "looks as though Snow White fell for the old apple routine again." "Either that or he's hibernating," came another voice Pitt recognized. He opened his eyes, shielded them from the sun with one hand, and looked up at a pair of grinning individuals who stared down. The shorter of the two, a barrel-chested, muscled character with black curly hair and the iron-bound look of a man who enjoyed eating bricks for breakfast, was Pitt's old friend and assistant projects director at NUMA, Al Giordino. Al reached down, grabbed an outstretched hand, and pulled Pitt to his feet as effortlessly as a sanitation worker picking up an empty beer can from parked grass. "Departure time in 12 minutes." "Our unnamed pilot arrive yet?" Pitt asked. The other man, slightly taller and much thinner than Giordino, shook his head. "No sign of one." Rudigan peered through a pair of blue eyes that were magnified by thick-lensed glasses. He had the appearance of an undernourished assistant bookkeeper toiling for a gold watch. The impression was deceptive. Gunn was the overseer of NUMA's oceanographic projects. While Admiral Sandecker waged pitched battles with Congress and the federal bureaucracy, Gunn watched over the agency's day-to-day operation. For Pitt, prying Gunn and Giordino from under Sandecker had been a major victory. "If we want to match LeBaron's departure time, we'll have to wrestle it aloft ourselves," said Giordino, unconcerned. "I guess we can manage," said Pitt. "You study the flight manuals?" Giordino nodded. "Requires 50 hours of instruction and flying time to qualify for a license. The basic control isn't difficult, but the art of keeping that pneumatic scrotum stable in a stiff breeze takes practice." Pitt couldn't help grinning at Giordino's colorful description. "The equipment loaded on board?" "Loaded and secured," Gunn assured him. "Then I guess we might as well shove off." As they approached the Prosper Tier, LeBaron's crew chief climbed down the ladder from the control car. He spoke a few words to one of the ground crew and then waved a friendly greeting. "She's all ready to go, gentlemen." "How close are we to the actual weather conditions of the previous flight?" asked Pitt. "Mr. LeBaron was flying against a 5-mile-an-hour headwind out of the southeast. You'll buck 8, so figure on compensating. There's a late-season hurricane moving in over the Turks and Caicos Islands. The meteorological guys christened her Little Eva because she's a small blow with a diameter no more than 60 miles wide. The forecasters think she'll swing north toward the Carolinas. If you turn back no later than 1,400 hours, Little Eva's outer breeze should provide you with a nice fat tailwind to nudge you home."
"And if we don't?"
"Don't what?"
"Swing back by 1,400 hours.
The crew chief smiled thinly.
"I don't recommend getting caught in a tropical storm with 50-mile-an-hour winds, at least not in an airship that's 60 years old.
"You make a strong case," Pitt admitted.
"Allowing for the headwind," said Gunn, "we won't reach the search area until 10:30 hours. That doesn't leave us much time to look around." Yes, Giordino said, but LeBaron's known flight path should put us right in the ballpark.
A tidy package, Pitt mused, to no one in particular.
Too tidy.
The three Numa men were about to climb on board when the LeBaron limousine pulled up beside the blimp. Angelo got out and smartly opened the passenger door. Jesse stepped into the sun and walked over, looking outdoorsy in a designer safari suit with her hair tied in a bright scarf, 1930 style. She was carrying a suede flight bag.
"Are we ready?" she said brightly, slipping past them and nimbly hustling up the ladder to the control car.
Gunn gave Pitt a grim look. "You didn't tell us we were going on a picnic."
"Nobody told me either," Pitt said, gazing up at Jesse, who had turned and was framed in the doorway.
"My fault," said Jesse. "I forgot to mention that I'm your pilot."
Giordino and Gunn looked as if they had swallowed live squid. Pitt's face wore an amused expression. He said,
"No kidding."
"Raymond taught me to fly the Prospertier," she said. "I've logged over 80 hours at the controls and have a license."
"No kidding," Pitt repeated, becoming intrigued.
Giordino failed to see the humor.
"Do you also know how to dive, Mrs. LeBaron?"
"Sky or scuba? I'm certified for both."
"We can't take a woman," said Gunn resolutely.
"Please, Mrs. LeBaron," pleaded the crew chief. "We don't know what happened to your husband. The flight might be dangerous."
"We'll use the same communication plan as Raymond's flight," she said, ignoring him. "If we find anything interesting, we'll transmit in normal voice. No code this time."
"This is ridiculous," snapped Gunn.
Pitt shrugged.
"Oh, I don't know. I'll vote for her."
"You don't really mean it."
"Why not?" replied Pitt with a sardonic grin. "I firmly believe in equal rights. She has just as much right to get herself killed as we do."
The ground crew stood as silent as pallbearers, their eyes following the old blimp as she lifted into the sunrise. Suddenly, she began dropping. They held their breath as the landing wheel touched the crest of a wave. Then she slowly bounced back into the air and struggled to rise. Someone muttered anxiously, "Lift, baby, lift." The Prospertier agonizingly rose a few feet at a time until she finally leveled out at a safe altitude. The ground crew watched motionless, staring until the blimp became a tiny dark speck above the silent horizon. They stood there when she was no longer in view, instinctively quiet, a sense of dread in their hearts. There would be no volleyball game this day. They all herded inside the maintenance truck, overburdening the air conditioning system, clustering around the radio. The first message came in at 0700 hours. Pitt explained away the shaky liftoff. Jesse had undercompensated for the lack of buoyancy caused by the extra payload Giordino and Gunn had placed on board. From then on until 1400 hours, Pitt kept the frequency open and maintained a running dialogue, matching his observations with the transcribed report that was recorded during LeBaron's flight. The crew chief picked up the microphone.
"Prospertier, this is Grandma's house. Over."
"Go ahead, Grandma."
"Can you give me your latest Vicor satellite position?"
"Roger. Vicor reading H3608 by T8090. The crew chief quickly plotted the position on a chart.
"Prospertier, you're looking good. I have you 5 miles due south of Guincho's Key on the Bahama Bank. Over."
"I read the same, Grandma."
"How are the winds?"
"Judging from the wave crests, I'd say the breeze has picked up to about 4-6 on the Beaufort scale."
"Listen to me, Prospertier. The Coast Guard has issued a new update on Little Eva. She has doubled her speed and swung east. Hurricane warnings are up throughout the southern Bahamas. If she sticks to her present course, she'll strike the east coast of Cuba sometime this evening. I repeat, Little Eva has swung east and is heading in your direction. Call it a day, Prospertier, and beat a course for home."
"Will do, Grandma. Turning on to new course for the Keys." Pitt was silent for the next half hour. At 1435 hours, the crew chief hailed again.
"Prospertier, come in, please. Over."
No reply.
"Come in, Prospertier. This is Grandma's house. Do you read?"
Still nothing. The stifling air inside the truck seemed suddenly to turn cold as fear and apprehension gripped the crew. The seconds crawled past and took forever to become minutes as the crew chief tried desperately to raise the blimp. But the Prospecteer did not respond. The crew chief slammed down the microphone and pushed his way outside the truck through the stunned ground crew. He ran over to the parked limousine and feverishly jerked open a rear door. "They're gone. We've lost them, the same as the last time." The man sitting alone in the rear seat simply nodded. "Keep trying to raise them," he said quietly. As the crew chief hurried back to the radio, Admiral James Sandecker lifted a telephone receiver from a varnished cabinet and placed a call. "Mr. President?" "Yes, Admiral." "They're missing." "Understood. I've briefed Admiral Clyde Montfort of the Caribbean Joint Task Force. He's already put ships and planes on alert around the Bahamas. As soon as we hang up, I'll order him to launch a search and rescue operation. Please impress upon Montfort the need for speed. I've also been informed the Prospecteur disappeared in the predicted path of a hurricane. Return to Washington, Admiral, and do not worry. Your people and Mrs. LeBaron should be sighted and picked up within a few hours." "I'll try to share your optimism, Mr. President. Thank you." If there was one doctrine Sandecker believed in with all his heart, it was never trust a politician's word. He placed another call on the limousine's phone. "Admiral James Sandecker, I'd like to speak with Admiral Montfort." "Right away, sir." "Jim, is that really you?" "Hello, Clyde. Good to hear your voice." "Damn, it's been nearly 2 years. What's on your mind?" "Tell me, Clyde, have you been alerted for a rescue mission in the Bahamas?" "Where did you hear that?"
"The rumor mill."
"News to me. Most of our Caribbean forces are conducting an amphibious landing exercise on Jamaica."
"Jamaica?"
"A little muscle-flexing display of military capability to shake up the Soviets and Cubans. Keeps Castro off balance, thinking we're going to invade one of these days."
"Are we?"
"What in hell for? Cuba is the best advertising campaign we've got running that promotes communism as a big economic bust. Besides, better the Soviet Union throws $12 million a day down Castro's toilet than us." "You've received no orders to keep an eye on a blimp that left on a flight from the Keys this morning?"
There was an ominous silence on the other end of the line.
"I probably shouldn't be telling you this, Jim, but I did receive a verbal order concerning the blimp. I was told to keep our ships and aircraft out of the Bahama banks and to put a blackout on all communications coming from the area."
"The order come direct from the White House?"
"Don't press your luck, Jim."
"Thanks for setting me straight, Clyde."
"Anytime. Let's get together next time I'm in Washington."
"I'll look forward to it."
Sandecker hung up, his face red with anger, his eyes fired with fury.
"God help them," he muttered through clenched teeth. "We've all been had.